Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Weekly Defence Podcast, and in fact our final news round of the year. I'm your host, Ben Vogel, and I'm joined today by our air, land, sea and training subject matter experts. So a big welcome to Flavia Camargos Pereira. Hi, Flavia.
Hello, Ben. Hi, all.
Tim Martin. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Ben.
Harry Lai. Hi, Harry.
Hello, Ben.
And last but, of course, not least, Trevor Nash. Hello, Trevor.
Hello, Ben.
So welcome to everybody, and I hope you're all doing well and looking forward to Christmas. Given that we are almost at the end of the year, in the news round this week, we'll be going over some of the main themes of 2021 in terms of our air, land, sea and training coverage. I'll also ask the panel to stick their necks out and make a prediction for 2022. And then we will hear from our Asia Pacific expert, Gordon Arthur, to hear his highlights of 2021. In the final segment of the final episode of the year, Tim Martin speaks with TJ Pope, Senior Director for Military Turboshaft Engines at Honeywell Aerospace, about the latest developments with the T-55-714C upgrade for US Army helicopters. But first, let's look back over 2021 with our panel of domain experts. And I would like to start with you, Tim, on the air side of things. And there has clearly been plenty of procurement activity to keep you busy over the past 12 months. What programs really stood out for you?
Yeah, I think probably one that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, I know there's maybe a recency effect here or a bias towards it, just because it's so recent, but the Rafale deal for the UAE, like huge, absolutely massive. And given that it was, you know, goes up back almost 10 years more to when Dassault were in negotiations originally for this, I don't think it was easy to see coming. So yeah, absolutely huge, just in terms of you know, the scale of it, the cost, and what it means, I guess, for the region as well, and what the UAE are doing in terms of air force modernization. Other than that, you know, a great year for Lockheed Martin and the F-35. You know, they took home the spoils from Switzerland, 36 aircraft. They just won HX, 64 aircraft. They're talking about the potential also for more orders in Europe. You know, their production line is almost back on to track, you know, pre-COVID levels and so forth, and running at full rate. So, you know, business is really steady, and, well, not just steady, booming really in terms of deliveries and sales and future orders and all the rest. And then, of course, next year we'll have Canada's Future Fighter program. And that's the next one, next big one to look out for. Again, F-35A is primed really to potentially take that. It would be a shock if Gripen ERF was to take home that one. So obviously we see where it goes, but I think that's predominantly been the, on the fighter side of things, that's been the major news.
Okay. Given what you've been saying, Tim, it looks as though certainly fixed wing fighter aircraft procurements this year have been generally unaffected by COVID-related uncertainty. Although it has to be said, we're in the middle of the Omicron outbreak right now. Is that a fair comment, though, that fixed wing programs generally have been pretty healthy?
Yeah, I would say so. I think also, you know, when you look at other things that might be coming down the track, the twists and turns have not really been down to money or anything like that. You look at, we're speaking, you know, on, in light of reports coming that the UAE has suspended the deal with the US government to procure up to a maximum of 50 F-35As and 18 MQ-9s. So that's all down really to what's said to be the US having a red line when it comes to technology and potentially difficulties around UAE having a contract with China on Huawei 5G. So, you know, that has nothing to do with money, quite frankly. And it's, you know, a huge deal, but it's not, it would have happened, you would imagine, in any other year, whether COVID was making life difficult or not. It doesn't seem to be that issues for the UAE in terms of money have led to any difficulties on that front. So yeah, generally speaking, I think it's fair to say that certainly fixed wing and fighter jet procurements not been hugely impacted.
Just turning to you personally, Tim, you were able to attend DSEI in September, and that was a significant event, first live trade show for a while. What really caught the eye for you from that show?
I think probably the talk around Tempest. You know, it's not a surprise that that would have been a priority and is a priority for British defence industry. So, you know, given that there's certain developments, particularly with the Excalibur, the 575 modified aircraft, it's going to be a Tempest test bed. There was finally a big announcement revealed on that front, to say that the first flight will happen in 2023, and that'll see future combat air technologies tested and also new sensors. So if all goes well, the idea is that a lot of the research and the testing will eventually then go on to the next generation fighter. So yeah, that I think that was particularly interesting to hear. And of course, you know, the bigger significance of having a show and being able to speak to people face to face is that you get kind of latest updates face to face. You're able to ask some more kind of difficult questions of those in the know, and you know, you generally don't get that anywhere else. Certainly, you know, when you're having back and forth emails with military sources and so forth, they're clearly guarded.
And just finally, Tim, I'm going to ask you to stick your neck out a little bit, look into your crystal ball. What's your feeling in terms of air procurement programs next year? What are the prospects? What's going to be the big headline, in your opinion, in 2022?
Well, I mean, there's certainly key decisions are going to have to be made when it comes to the US Army's future vertical lift. So we'll see a contract for FLRAA handed out, and you know, I'm not going to suggest which of the two aircraft is going to make the cut for that one. But, you know, I would say that if development in terms of testing is going to be going to have a big impact on that decision, then you would have to think then it'll be the V-280 that'll get selected, you know, given that previously we've heard about some of the difficulties with the SB-1 Defiant, just in the design and development program of that aircraft. So, yeah, well, that's maybe me sticking my neck out, suggesting that the things look like Bell is going to take that one. But other than that, I think actually it'll be really interesting to see if the F-16 deal for Turkey comes to pass. Turkey are demanding that the US provide compensation for being booted off the F-35, and they want new F-16s. Bit of an impasse at the moment on that one, but let's see where that goes. And I think that would be one that I'll certainly be keeping an eye on.
Thank you, Tim. And you'll be keeping, as you say, a close eye on developments next year. Over to Flavia now. And you've had a very busy 2021 for all manner of reasons, but you were able to check out AUSA in Washington in October. What did you make of that?
Actually, Ben, it was my first AUSA. And to be honest, it surprised me. I mean, there are so many companies together, so many people, and it was really interesting to see them, to see this trade show after after seeing many trade shows and conference and events being canceled in the last year and in this year as well. But anyway, we covered many interesting stories in the AUSA. I can say the industry is quite focused on lasers, on cryo systems, on hybrid technologies, electric propulsions. And an interesting story we covered there was about an all-terrain platform called Steed that uses NASCAR technology. It's the technology used in car races here in the States. And this platform is manufactured by Hendrick Motorsports and is undergoing trials with the U.S. Army and with the U.S. Marine Corps. And it was really interesting to understand how they are using their background on competitions, races, and how they are applying these to produce defense solutions.
Interesting example of commercial technology perhaps being leveraged by the military. But just turning away from the US for a moment, Flavia, looking at the world as a whole, at your areas of coverage, what stories were the most interesting from your point of view?
Actually, there were many interesting stories this year, Ben. It's really hard to point out only one. But I think in general, we have been covering stories involving unmanned systems. And I think it's a really big issue. It's really important for ground forces to develop these technologies and to access these technologies in order to protect troops on the battlefield. And we saw some developments in this area. For example, the Israeli IEI presented a new product. And I mean, we had many interesting stories during this year involving land forces and land technologies. But I would say something that also came to my mind is how the armies have been playing with 5G. I mean, they have been experienced, they have been trying the best ways to use 5G and how to improve their communication systems by using 5G. And I wrote a story speaking about the Norwegian Defense Forces and how they have been testing this, which I think it was really interesting story. And I also covered some tests with unmanned systems using 5G in Latvia. I think it's a really interesting story as well. And from U.S. point of view, I would say the main story this year, I know we have been speaking about this program a lot, but I would say the OMFV was the main story this year. I think we have to speak about this program because it's going to be a game changer. It's going to be the next generation of ground vehicles. So it'll feature cutting edge systems. So I think we can't avoid speaking about this. But I think it's interesting to highlight that at the AUSA, some companies disclose details on the designs they have been working on. The OMFV is the Army's fourth attempt to replace the M2 Bradley, and this program is currently in the concept design. And this year, in July, the Army, under this stage, under the concept design phase, the Army awarded contracts to five companies to develop digital concept designs for the OMFV. It involved kind of like values like $300 million, only this stage. And the competitors, they kind of, some of them presented what they have been working on. I think the main surprise in this phase was the Point Blank company, because it's an armor and ballistic protection company, and it was selected for this concept design phase. Currently, they are teaming Kashyyyk Mobile Power Systems, and they are offering the Liberty platform. And it's interesting to highlight at the AUSA, Point Blank was the only company that didn't present details of the design. I mean, they didn't put anything on display there. And apart from Point Blank, the other companies, they presented designs. They had an idea on what they have been working. And the other competitors are American Rheinmetall, BAE Systems, General Dynamic Land Systems, Oshkosh Defense, and Point Blank. Yeah.
So this is clearly going to be a strong area of focus for you next year, to look at the US Army vehicle programs like OMFV. But Flavia, if we can just turn to the other side of the Atlantic, and specifically the UK, in contrast to some other countries that have been able to make positive progress on their armored vehicle programs, in the UK, it does seem to be a slightly more problematic story. I'm talking, of course, about the Ajax vehicle, but what other kind of UK programs, as well as Ajax, caught your attention in 2021?
Actually, 2021 was an year in which we covered many stories from British Army, some positive, some, let's say, not so much positive, but there were a lot of things going on in the British armored programs. So in March, for example, the Defense Committee, the House of Commons Defense Committee, warned in a report that the British Army was at a serious risk of being outmatched by peer adversaries due to its aging fleet of ground vehicles. This report, it's a quite strong word, but this report called deplorable the recent history of the UK armored fighting vehicle capability.
Well, it was said also, with some justification, it seems, judging by subsequent revelations, it seems to have been certainly quite justified.
Yeah, actually, the Army has been facing some problems in these programs, and it has been quite challenging to make progress in some of them. But I think we have to speak about the integrated review. In March, the MOD disclosed details of the second part of the integrated review, and it gave us a better idea on the ways the British Army intends to pass through. For example, it stated that the Army would progress with the Ajax and Boxer procurement, as well as with the Challenger 2 life extension progress. But at the same time, the MOD terminated the Warrior upgrade program after spending around £400 million. And it's interesting to highlight that the Boxer, both Boxer and Ajax, were already contractually committed before the integrated review. And but let's say the Ajax has been a headache for the MOD. Issues related to excessive vibration and noise and its impact on soldiers' health have delayed the program. And as well as the COVID-19 situation forced the Army to stop testing the Ajax. But I think we have to speak about as well. Early this week, the MOD has published a health and safety report on the Ajax. It pointed out serious failings in the program and stressed that the Ajax may have contributed to hearing loss in a small number of soldiers. But it's something to think about, something to be worried, because let's say it's not the most comfortable situation to be sent to a battlefield in a platform with excessive noise and vibration. It's not a health for the human body. Yeah. And this report, Ben, also noted that the vehicles delivered for use in trials had these levels of noise and vibration. The levels were higher than the level that's expected in tracked vehicles.
It's incredible, isn't it? And I'm sure that this is something that, again, as with the US programs, you're going to be keeping an eye on the fate of Ajax in 2022. Will it be salvaged? Can it be saved? Do you have any other predictions for next year? I did ask Tim to stick his neck out a bit earlier, so it's your turn now.
Okay. From a British point of view, you'd say it'll be quite hard to put the Ajax on track again, thinking about the British programs. Then the Challenger 3, since the MOD have been awarding contracts under these programs, I think it'll move forward in 2022, especially because the British Army needs to have better equipped tanks to have this armored protection for their ground forces, ground troops. And early this year, the UK Secretary of State for Defense, Ben Wallace, said he was determined to accelerate the introduction of the Challenger 3 into service. So I understand the program would be on track the next year. And from an American point of view, you'd say a program we should try to pay attention next year is the Cold Weather All-Terrain Vehicle, CATV, the U.S. Army CATV, because probably the Army will pick the platform. And, of course, the OMFV. We have to keep an eye on this program, because for sure we have many news related to these programs. And I think probably we have interesting stories related to the Project Convergence as well, because the Army has been experimenting new technologies, and for sure some new approach or new solution will come out from these tests.
Thank you very much, Flavia. Turning to the naval domain now, and Harry, I think you're at a slight disadvantage compared to some of the other members of the team, because you did only join us in June, but you've been working very hard over the past 6 months, and there's plenty of coverage for you to look back on. So what would you say is the main story of the year from the naval domain?
I mean, other than AUKUS, which I'm sure Gordon has got covered, being close to the region. Probably the biggest and most consequential has been the Carrier Strike Group 2021 deployment, for both good and bad reasons. Obviously, it's been quite a sight to see a Royal Navy aircraft carrier at sea once again, and with a carrier air wing exclusively of fifth generation fighter jets, albeit some of them from the US Marine Corps. So that's been quite the sight to see, and it's the ships are back in the UK now, but it was a bit of a mammoth deployment as well, kind of around 7 months plus, visiting plenty of different countries and operating with lots of other kind of allies around the world at the same time. So it's definitely been the Royal Navy kind of stamping its mark back on the world and reminding everyone that it's here. But then obviously for the bad reasons, as well as the HMS Diamond suffering a few mechanical issues and raising questions about the kind of integrity of the Type 45 destroyer fleet. And then obviously, not too long ago, the F-35 going plop off the deck, which made for some quite stunning images.
Indeed, yeah. I think there was some video footage circulating on social media of the F-35 just falling off the end of the flight deck.
Yeah, that it did the rounds. It was leaked. I mean, it appeared to be a video of the ship's internal CCTV system that was filmed on someone's phone. And by the sounds of it, an arrest has been made in relation to that. So obviously quite serious matter to be filming the internal CCTV of a warship. So imagine that didn't go down well with MOD HQ, but made interesting viewing for the rest of us.
Right, so highs and lows with Carrier Strike Group 21. Let's look at other naval programs around the world, in Europe, for instance. What stood out for you this year?
Yes, so probably the major European procurement has been the Greece's ongoing Hellenic Navy modernization requirement, which was originally for new frigates, an interim stopgap solution, and the upgrade of its Mekko frigates. It was an international competition, lots of countries threw their hat into the ring. You had Italy with its version of FREM, France with the FDI frigate, which I do know the acronym, but I'm not going to butcher the pronunciation of. Then you also had the UK, the the UK with its Type 31. I will not be drawn on that, I'm afraid. I'll just stick with FDI. And the US with the Hellenic Future Frigate, or HF2. And so it was quite a sweeping requirement. You had the UK reportedly offering Type 23s as the interim solution, some of those that were recently retired. But it all seemed to be wrapped up when Greece decided to buy some frigates from France, from Naval Group, the FDI, straight off the production line. But since then, we've seen that Greece has continued negotiations with other countries and signed a letter of intent with the Dutch for the supply of mine hunting vessels and two Carol Dorman class frigates. And then most recently, you had two foreign military sales notifications from the US agreeing to basically sell the Greeks a Mekko upgrade and the Hellenic Future frigate. So by all accounts, I mean, Greece is definitely buying the frigates from France, but I don't think that's going to stop them going elsewhere to fill their other requirements, which is clearly they need ships.
Yeah, certainly a major procurement surge in the Aegean and Mediterranean. Can I just ask you, Harry, about other technological developments on the naval side this year? What kind of trends have you noticed in the naval domain?
So as with air and land, uncrewed technology is still right up there. And so one major program update we saw was the delivery of two uncrewed mine hunting systems, one to the UK and one to France, as part of the joint MMCM program. So while a couple of other joint French, British works have kind of fallen by the wayside in the AUKUS political battles and the arguments over fish, the mine hunting program seems to have carried on quite well. And we've had deliveries of the first systems to the French DGA and the UK Royal Navy. So they will be put through their paces and work will continue on that program with four systems due to be delivered to each country by 2024. Also, in the uncrewed space, the US has been doing a lot of work in the Fifth Fleet area of operations. So it's set up an uncrewed systems task force, which has been working with a lot of allies in the region to test some small USVs and kind of figure out what they're capable of.
And actually, in the Fifth Fleet as well, there was just some news the other day of USS Portland, I think, test firing a laser weapon in the Gulf of Aden. So certainly that part of the world, the US naval presence is very keen to trial new technologies.
Definitely. It seems to be a bit of a hub for technological development at the moment.
And following the theme from Flavia and Tim, stick your neck on the block, Harry, and give us a prediction for 2022.
It's obviously hard to say with any certainty, but I think that for sure we will see Greece order some more ships from other countries, whether that's the US providing some kind of old Ticonderoga-class cruisers or littoral combat ships as excess defence articles, or whether it's an order of Hellenic future frigates. But looking at the direction of travel for Greece, I don't think they're anywhere near done with their plans to buy ships. And it seems like the FDI is just the start.
Okay, well, it's turning into an epic story for sure. Thank you very much, Harry. Last but not least, let's turn to Trevor. I know you've been waiting very patiently, so thank you for staying patient, Trevor. Now, I think you're unique among the people on the NewsRound panel today in actually attending two live trade shows this year. You're at DSEI and ITSEC, which was recently completed. So how was getting back on the show scene for you?
It was great. ITSEC was clearly warmer than DSEI in London. That was the main difference. But, you know, I'd like to pick up on something that Tim mentioned earlier on, and that is the benefit that we get from shows, us journalists getting around to speak to people, is phenomenal. And, you know, one of the things that I've always said about trade shows, you can chat to somebody on a stand, they can tell you something, you can have a cup of coffee, mull it over, and then go to the competitor who's two rows down the next aisle and chat to him. So you can do a lot of comparing and contrasting and looking at your notes. So that is very useful on the trade show front. But it was great to be back out there, Ben. And the interesting thing was, at ITSEC in Orlando, I spoke to numerous companies over there, and I put this question to them, you know, this blessed COVID has been affecting us for 2 years, but now, you know, what's it like being back on the show floor? And it was unanimous. Everybody was very positive about it, seeing, you know, friends and colleagues again. So thumbs up to that. And let's hope that the current variant doesn't stop us going to trade shows for too long in the future.
Indeed, we're crossing fingers.
And just to chime in there as well, I mean, it was quite funny, coincidental, that first time all of us were on it at trade show floor, then at DSEI, AUKUS broke. And it was, you know, it's for us in the trade journalists. Now, clearly it was broken at a political level, and we were just all watching it, you know, on the big screen and stuff. But, you know, to kind of have that feeling again of, you know, big news breaking and, you know, working at the coalface, you know, it was really, really great. And then, you know, we did the podcast all kind of just giving our immediate reaction to the news and so forth. It was, you know, and that wouldn't have happened but for the show itself. You know, we would have kind of been out in the cold, so to speak. So it was really, really interesting.
Yeah, just to add on that as well, I mean, great to be at a trade show, especially when big news like that does come up, because being in the trade press, it's not that often that you get to kind of put a question directly to the defence secretary. And so being back at a show gave me the opportunity to do that, which made for a good story. So it's certainly been missed.
Indeed. And absolutely what Trevor was saying is completely correct from my point of view too, being able to attend DSEI, my first show for Shepherd. So back to you, Trevor. I mean, you did have an extremely active year, covering the whole range of training topics that are available to you. So it's a rather difficult question to ask you what were the highlights, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What were the highlights?
I think primarily it was on the corporate industrial front, in terms of there were couple of takeovers, major takeovers, and a smaller change in ownership, which are fascinating. The major takeover of the three, I guess, is CAE taking over the training and training services business of L3, Harris Technologies, what we call L3 Link. That's phenomenal, because Link were a very big company providing training equipment, training services. And they were well placed in a number of US programs and also FMS programs around the world. So we talk about COVID affecting companies, and really, you know, the inference there is that companies are being suppressed by COVID. But there we have, in the height of COVID, CAE saying, no, we're going to take over a major element to add to our portfolio, which is really quite amazing.
A bold statement of intent.
Yeah, absolutely, Ben. And I think the thing is that Harris, L3Harris Technologies, wanted to, you know, slim down their assets and focus more. And so training for them was, you know, not really core to them. So they got rid of it. And that was another reason why RUAG Simulation and Training came on the market a little bit later in the year. RUAG wanted to concentrate on the space sector. And so therefore, Thales picked up RUAG Simulation and Training. And there with RUAG, their speciality is live ground training, virtual small arms trainers, and Thales picked them up. There's been no reference to how much they cost, but my view is they got them for a song. And the third one, although not massive financially, was BAE Systems, the mega defence contractor BAE Systems, buying the little relatively tiddly, Bohemia Interactive Simulations, because BSIM, although they were owned by a venture capital company, they were seen as sort of independent, honest brokers, deal with anybody. And then BAE Systems have come in. And the initial reaction from people around the world was, well, you know, if BAE Systems have got them, BAE Systems is a big integrator, a big defence contractor. Are they going to stop the BSIM technology going to other integrators? Well, I spoke to BSIM about this at the ITSEC, and they said, no, that is not going to be the case. They're maintaining their name, and they're going to maintain independence and deal with their current customers, which is good news for the industry.
Okay. And very interesting overview of the mergers and acquisitions landscape in your sector. But in terms of technology and new kinds of training technology that have been coming on stream this year, or if not new technologies, then the evolving use of novel technologies or recently introduced systems. Was there anything in that sense that stood out?
If I can turn that question around, Ben, and say a novel technology which has taken a retrograde step to a certain extent, and that is in the live air training sector, ACMI, Autonomous Combat Maneuvering Instrumentation. That has been very big over the years, and it's increased its fidelity. It's become more capable. But the number of contracts, and we'd normally expect around 2, 3, maybe 4 contracts a year in that sector, that's sort of dried up over the last couple of years. And so I put this question to two of the biggest players in this sector, Elbit and IAI, who both offer this system called Airhood. And I got two slightly different answers. Both agreed that they think that there is a market saturation at the moment, and therefore there's very little room to move in and sell new product. Elbit said to me that they believe that there's also an issue with modern combat aircraft having their own data links, having the computational capability to have, if you will, integral ACMI. And so therefore, there's no real need, because they can use the data link to swap data between aircraft, and therefore you don't need a specialized pod. I spoke to a consultant who works for IAI USA, and he said he agrees with market saturation, but he believes the second reason really is to do with the current US Air Force, US military ACMI system. It's called P5, and it's developed by DRS and Cubic. He said that P5 is there. P5 is being sold quite happily at the moment in terms of every F-35 that goes out the door. Basically, it's got an internal P5 capability. He said, but at the moment, Collins Aerospace have developed what has become known as P6. And he said that the fact that the P6 is coming online, although it's taking some time to become ready, there's a confusion in the market between P5 and P6, and customers are saying, well, we're going to give it a little while and weigh up the benefits of both systems before they make decisions. So that's the reason for that slowing. On the service, training service provision side of the house, I must admit, I was a little bit shocked that it's gone so well, and that is this NFTE, NATO Flight Training Europe program. Historically, Europe has developed two of these programs in the past, not through NATO, but trying to develop centralized training systems for European air forces. They've been disastrous, but NATO seems to have grabbed this by the horns, and it's going forward very well. There are 10 NATO nation members involved in the program, and recently they've just announced the two first training centers to come online. One, unsurprisingly, is the Leonardo CAE International Flight Training Center. That's come online. And the other one is run by Lom Praha in the Czech Republic, and that's come online. And basically, both of these are for fast jet training. As I understand it, IFTS is going to offer phase 4 advanced jet training, whilst Lom Praha will do the phase 2 initial pilot training and phase 3 introduction to jet aircraft. So there seems to be a good meshing together of skills with those two organisations. And as I say, I take my hat off to NATO because they've stuck exactly to the milestones that they've given. And the first students, NATO tell me, will be going through those programmes at the end of 22, beginning of 23.
Okay, well, it certainly seems to be a model of how to run a cross-border programme. With NFTE. You mentioned 2022 as a milestone in that program, the NFTE program, Trevor. So that does bring me on to my customary question in this particular news round. Ask you to look ahead and tell listeners what to expect on the trading side of things in 2022.
Historically, and I've spoken about this before, but historically, there have been set phases of pilot training which haven't changed very much since the Second World War. What we're seeing now is some of those phases are being cut out. And as I've said, on numerous occasions, the pilot training side of the house is using lower cost simulation systems where, through the use of machine learning and AI, trainees are able to go through the training requirement at their own pace. So we're seeing phases cut out, and we're seeing people doing more training at their own pace. That's one thing on the pilot training side. On the land side, there's a big debate at the moment about military ranges. Now, these haven't changed since the Napoleonic Wars. You basically get somebody, they go there with their musket or assault rifle, and they whack off rounds down at targets on a linear shoot. More sophisticated ranges have got electronic pop-up targets or targets that move, laterally. There is this move promoted by the autonomous target manufacturers, these targets that can move in directions. They have AI, they can respond to being fired at, et cetera, for these ranges to be changed, so you have these more autonomous target-driven ranges. And it's taken a bit of a time. The US Marine Corps are, looking at this seriously now. They have adopted some of these targets, and ditto for the US Army. Big programs going on there. And so those I see, more realistic ranges in the future and changes to the pilot training program pipeline.
Thank you, Trevor. Some things to look out for next year.
Trevor, I also just wanted to chime in because when I was up at RAF Waddington for a flight demo of Protector, and I was being talked about, or the RAF were mentioning for the first time that RAF Waddington would be the home of the International Training Centre for Protector. And I know you wrote on this as well, but I mean, just if you can explain, I guess, the significance of that and you know, how important it is then, and particularly Waddington being the home of iStar for the RAF and so forth. You know, yeah. A good idea, generally.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the Dutch are very interested in that programme. It seems crazy at the moment within Europe that air forces have got reduced fleets across the board. So does it make sense to have your own dedicated training centre, national training centre? It doesn't really. So the idea of bringing people together to, you know, train, for instance, the Dutch and whoever else come along, the Belgians probably, to the our ISTAR Centre of Excellence at RAF Waddington, it will make sense for them to come there and do that. And ditto, really, we've also seen another example of that with France and Germany buying the C-130J. They've got a common squadron and a common training centre, so it makes sense because it saves money, is more effective, and also provides a forum for exchanging ideas, tactics, training, and, you know, procedures. So, yeah.
Certainly seems to be a trend towards what you might call European defragmentation.
Oh, I like that, Ben. That's good.
Yeah. Borrowed from the air traffic management world. So, thank you very much indeed, Trevor. And thanks you also to Flavia, Tim and Harry. That wraps up this week's news round. And for our listeners, if you do want to find out more about our defence news and analysis, or look at previous episodes of the podcast, or listen to previous episodes of the podcast, please visit our website, www.shepherdmedia.com/news. So that's all from me, Tim, Flavia, Trevor and Harry this year. A Merry Christmas to everybody on the panel today, and a Merry Christmas to all the listeners. We will now go into a short break, and then I'll return in conversation with Gordon Arthur.
And in many cases, they're being used well beyond their expected life, which means they're breaking down more often because they're getting older. And as a result, they can't fly as often. So that degrades readiness.
A platform typically operates multiple decades. You know, there's platforms out there that have been flying for 40 or 50 years. And this sustainment approach is critical, again, so that 40-year-old aircraft can achieve its mission when called upon.
This is Shepherd Studios Critical Care Podcast, the story of military aircraft sustainment and support in an unpredictable world. Over 4 episodes, we take a look at the role of sustainment in ensuring fleet readiness, consider the part that technology plays in reducing downtime, and hear about the advantages of greater collaboration between industry and the military. In this first episode, we hear how militaries are turning to new innovative sustainment models to maintain their aviation fleets.
So we've seen great success with being able to increase their operational readiness rates, improve their safety, and reduce their flying hour costs.
Airplanes are fabulously expensive. But we have to be careful that we don't substitute aircraft that cost $40,000 a flight hour for aircraft that cost $15,000 a flight hour and think that that's going to help our readiness.
Episode 1 of the Critical Care Podcast is out now on shepherdmedia.com/news or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm delighted to be joined from New Zealand by Shepherd's Asia-Pacific editor, Gordon Arthur, to talk over some of the most significant topics from the region in 2021. Hi, Gordon. How are you?
Hi there, Ben. Good to talk to you again.
So you're enjoying the summer or not?
I'm not. No, it's been pretty miserable so far here in New Zealand, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, hopefully you get some rays of sunshine before long. So we're looking back over 2021 in the, well, I suppose we could call it the tense Asia-Pacific region. It was ever thus in a way. But how would you summarise developments this year?
Yeah, you mentioned tensions, and I think there's been a number that have continued through. So obviously the South China Sea continues to be one where China wants to control that particular body of water. I think Taiwan, the plight of Taiwan has grown in the public's mind over the past year as China's become more and more threatening towards it. One good piece of news, there hasn't been an outbreak of fighting along the Sino-Indian border as there was the year before. So that was good. Not to say that the tensions don't still exist and that forces are still built up either side of the border. But probably one of the most heart-wrenching cases, and who can forget the images of Afghans wanting to flee their country after the American pullout. So 15th August, the Taliban, after sweeping through the country pretty much almost unopposed, they took control of Kabul. And of course, we do remember those horrible images of people just wanting desperately to leave before the Taliban got their hands on them.
Yeah, reminiscent of Saigon 1975 in many ways.
Exactly, and certainly a complete and utter failure on behalf of the Americans in terms of intelligence, in terms of training, in terms of planning and their troop pullout.
Indeed, and the consequences of that American withdrawal will continue to play out into 2022 and beyond, probably.
Mm.
In terms of some of the other stories and topics that you covered this year, and again, this is related to geopolitical strategy and regional tensions to some degree. There was actually news that broke while the rest of us were in London at the SEI, news that broke on the other side of the world about a security pact between the UK, Australia and the US. Perhaps you could tell us a bit more about that.
Yes, nuclear submarines for Australia. Who would have thunk it? when was it? Mid-September, AUKUS announcement came out. And so AUKUS is obviously a trilateral security arrangement, but certainly a big part of it was this aim to give the Australians nuclear-powered submarines. Let's be very careful, not nuclear-armed, but nuclear-powered. And at the same time, they basically tore up the contract it had with Naval Group for 12 attack-class submarines. And the more I've thought about this and the more I've looked at it and the more that the news has come out, Ben, it just seems that the whole thing was completely disorganized. The very day that the announcement came out, the Australian Department of Defence had issued a letter to Naval Group to say that they'd approved the next phase of the project. I mean, it just like one hand didn't know what the other was doing. And they've given themselves 18 months to sort of study and decide what course of action to take in terms of obtaining nuclear submarines. I mean, that very fact tells you that they hadn't thought about it already. So it just seems to me hugely disorganized. And thinking about some of the problems Australia's had with other naval and defense programs, I'm not optimistic that they're going to be getting their hands on nuclear-powered submarines anytime soon.
Right. So it's clearly a complete change of tack on the part of the Australian Navy and the Australian government. This is a new capability that Australians have never had before. So they really are making a break with the past, and it will take a while, you think, for this program to be implemented satisfactorily.
Absolutely. I think it is a bold move. But then again, they should have considered this before they opted to go for the French attack class submarines. I mean, if the analysts and forecasters had their glasses on, they would have realised that China was going to be a threat and that nuclear-powered submarines were probably going to be the best bet to help counter that. So I think, again, a lack of foresight on the part of planners in Australia, just like those Americans in Afghanistan, I'm afraid.
Indeed, a theme is developing here. But in terms of other Australian procurement programs, of course, this year has been extremely active and very busy on other fronts as well. what would you say are the main features of Australian defence procurement apart from the nuclear submarines this year?
Well, let's continue that theme, Ben, because here we go again, this time helicopters. So we've had two announcements this past year, and both of them amount to Australia ditching its European helicopter designs or platforms. So in January, they told us that they were going to finally put to bed the Tiger armed reconnaissance helicopter. Now, we've known about this for years and years, total dissatisfaction on behalf or on the part of the Australian Army about the availability rates of the Tiger. It's interesting that, I mean, they had been getting their act together, Airbus helicopters, and rates and availability were definitely improving. A lot of the problems were being ironed out. But I'm afraid, I think by then, the Army had just lost patience. So they're going to replace the Tiger with the AH-64E Apache from Boeing. They haven't mentioned a number, but we do know that when they first released their tender document, they were looking for 29 Apache helicopters. So that's a big step for Australia. And very similarly, the MRH-90, which is the Australian version of the NH-90, again, a lot of problems with that particular helicopter program. In fact, it's been on the projects of concern list that the Australians have since 2011. So that's 10 years they've been unhappy with the MRH-90. Just the expense of running it and also the availability levels. So again, I think it's very similar to the Tiger. They've just had enough and they've decided to divest themselves of that fleet. No date has been put on that yet. But Australia's already been making official or formal inquiries to the US about obtaining the UH-60M Black Hawk. So there we go, two European helicopters being ditched and two American ones being chosen to replace it.
As you say, continuation of the theme. What's going to happen to the Tiger and the MRH-90? Are they going to be just scrapped or... are the Aussies going to sell them on second hand, do you think?
Well, I assume that they're going to sell them. So if you think about what Australia did with its Sea Sprite naval helicopters, they actually sold them to New Zealand. New Zealand also has
the coming your way then.
Yeah, New Zealand has the NH-90, very similar configuration. So perhaps the New Zealanders will be interested. I'm sure there'll be demand on the second hand market for them. So. Yeah.
Okay. In terms of land systems, there's been a lot of movement in terms of artillery procurement this year as well from Australia, I believe.
Yeah, this is another interesting one. So I think it was about 8 years ago, Australia had actually been running a tender to look for a self-propelled howitzer. The one that had sort of been pointed towards was the K9 from Hanwha. Well, at that point, it was Samsung Tekwin. That was the one that had been decided was the best. And Australia suddenly got cold feet and decided to pull the plug on it. I think there was a bit of xenophobia in there. They'd never bought anything from Asia before, and they decided they wouldn't go ahead with it. Here we are, 8 years later, and they've just signed a contract on the 13th of December for the Australian Army to buy 30 AS9 Huntsman self-propelled howitzers and to support them 15 AS10 ammunition resupply vehicles. So a figure amount hasn't been put on it, but probably around about $1 billion Australian dollars, which is about $720 odd million. So Australia will be receiving its first self-propelled howitzer, and significantly, it will be the largest deal, a more military deal, that Australia's had with any Asian country to date.
Right, could be a sign of the times, maybe something for 2022 to sort of bear out in greater consequence.
Yeah, especially as Land 400 Phase 3, Australia's looking for a new infantry fighting vehicle. Hanwha is also in with a chance there.
Okay. Of course, we can't talk about developments this year in the Asia-Pacific region without mentioning Beijing and its ever-increasing ambitions and ever-increasing assertiveness, it seems, in trying to achieve its geopolitical objectives. You've been covering a number of different strands of this over the course of the past 12 months, Gordon. So perhaps you could sort of highlight some of the major developments.
Yeah, I mean, there's been an awful lot that has happened. So we can't cover everything, obviously, as much as we'd like to. But I'll give you two choices. You can decide which you'd like to cover first, Ben. You can either do missiles or fighters. Which would you like to start off?
Let's go with missiles.
Right. So some huge jaw-dropping revelations in terms of missiles. This past year, in fact, within the past 6 months, when it comes to China. So earlier this year, there was a discovery made, 16 missile silos in Jilantai in Inner Mongolia, which is a training area. That was very small because not long after that, they discovered from people using open source satellite imagery, a huge missile silo base. In Gansu province, and there's about 120 missile silos under construction there. So these would presumably be for DF-41 intercontinental ballistic missiles. Not long after that, in eastern Xinjiang, they discovered another missile silo field with 110 silos, and then another smaller field was also discovered. I'm sure we'll find more over time as well. But yeah, just an incredible number of new missile silos being created. I don't for a moment believe that every single silo is going to be filled with a missile, but it does indicate a huge expansion in the nuclear missile arsenal of China. And this was confirmed in November when the US Pentagon released its annual report on the Chinese military. And they were saying by 2030, so that's 9 years from now, or just about 8 years, in fact, because we're almost at the end, China will quadruple its nuclear stockpile compared to what it is now. That's four times expansion. Last year, they were predicting it would double. This year, they're saying it will quadruple. So that's just a staggering increase in the number of nuclear missiles.
The implications of this are pretty severe, obviously, in terms of a potential nuclear arms race, particularly with India as a nuclear power.
Yep. Also, the Pentagon told us that China probably has a viable nuclear triad now. So it's got air-launched ballistic missiles that it can use from H-6N bombers. It introduced yet another Type 094 ballistic missile submarine this year, on top of two last year. So it now has six of those. So an incredible number of nuclear weapons being produced in China. But that wasn't all, Ben. There was more.
Even more.
So sometime in late July or early August, there was a very secretive and very mysterious test of a missile and hypersonic glide vehicle. So most are calling it a fractional orbital bombardment system. So a rocket launches a warhead, it circles the Earth and then impacts. So China has denied that it's done such a test, of course.
Of course,
I think there's general consensus amongst everyone else that this was such a test. That was just astounding, just the different tests that China has done. It's also got the DF-17 hypersonic missile. The Pentagon believes it was operationally fielded last year. So looking ahead to next year, I think we're going to continue to see such stunning revelations regarding different Chinese missiles, missile types, different types of missile tests. And then, If you listen to the Chinese spokesmen, they will always accuse America of a Cold War mentality. But we do have to ask the question, Ben, who has the Cold War mentality? I mean, quadrupling your nuclear arsenal, introducing some of these missile systems that were fielded or dreamed of in the Cold War period between the US and the USSR. China's doing most of the running at the moment.
Yeah, not to mention the persistent saber rattling towards Taiwan as well as another example of this mentality. Thank you, Gordon. I think you were going to mention fighters as well.
Yes, just for the sake of time, I'll just very briefly skim over it. So China has two fifth generation or stealth fighter programs ongoing at the moment. So in late October, we saw the maiden flight of a twin-seat J-20 stealth fighter. Right at the end of the same month, we saw the maiden flight of a new carrier-borne fighter for the PLA Navy. Whether it's called the J-31 or J-35, not a whole lot of consensus yet. So those were two brand new fighters, still under development, obviously, but China has is continuing to test and develop those. At the same time, just a couple of days after that, there was the KJ-600 airborne early warning aircraft, also designed for carrier operations. It also flew in China as well. So there's a lot of development, a lot of activity, a lot of frenetic activity in the Chinese aerospace industry at the moment.
Indeed, and China's neighbours could be forgiven, rather, for feeling somewhat nervous as we move towards 2022. Now, Gordon, I asked the other members of the editorial team for a prediction about what to expect next year, and you've already given a little bit of a prediction in terms of Chinese ICBM and hypersonic activity. Do you have any others for the Asia-Pacific region?
Yeah, I think all of my predictions would continue to center around China. Unfortunately, it seems to be a common denominator in most of the tensions that are ongoing within Asia-Pacific. So I expect to see continued sort of posturing between India and China along the border. The South China Sea will continue to be an area of tension. So every time a foreign power passes a warship or a military aircraft through the area, China will jump up and down. Perhaps we'll see some vigorous actions by the maritime militia or the Coast Guard against civilian, like fishing boats and so on. Taiwan, I think the pressure will continue to ramp up by China. So at the same time, perhaps other countries like the US, Australia, Japan will rally around and offer greater support to Taiwan. And I think China's criticism of Japan will continue as well, as will its current hate affair with Australia. So, yeah, those are my predictions, Ben.
Thank you very much, Gordon. It was a pleasure to speak to you, and may I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
The very same to you, Ben. Thank you.
From your home office to out at sea to on mission, Shepherd News is used by more than 4 million government, military and industry professionals across the globe. So what are you waiting for? Start your 14-day free trial to premium news and join ranks with those in the know. Head to shepherdmedia.com/subscribe today.
I'm Shepherd Media's our editor, Tim Martin, and I'm delighted to say I'm joined by TJ Pope from Honeywell as we discuss the company's T55 engine program. TJ, first of all, it's brilliant to be speaking with you today, and thanks so much for joining the podcast.
Thank you, Tim. It's great to be here.
So I just wanted to begin with an announcement from Honeywell that mentioned that the T-55 has just gone through its first engine to test Can you give us a little bit of background as to how that came about and, you know, the progress that you've had in terms of moving the program forward?
Sure, absolutely. So the T55-714C upgrade is a program that Honeywell provide additional capability to the U.S. Army and Boeing's other customers to lower the cost of operation, provide increased flight range and fuel efficiency, and of course, improve the power and max gross weight of the CH-47 platform as well. And in doing that, we have now built our first engine and begun testing that engine, which is a significant achievement for the program. And it's the culmination, really, of all the hard work of the design team and also our supply chain and sourcing teams and procuring those parts and the manufacturing team in getting the engine put together so that we can start that integration and validation and really show what this engine is capable of in a lab setting. So the engineering and procurement processes are coming to life and are now in a running engine that has to date moved through continuous power, through maximum continuous power, which is very critical in demonstrating that our mechanical design is viable and that we are operating as desired. And in the meantime, we're collecting all the key performance data that we will provide to the customer to help them understand the overall benefit of the engine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and maybe for some listeners that might be a little less familiar with a first engine test, mm-hmm. what exactly does it involve? Is it more so that you're doing things on a stand, or are you actually putting it into the CH-47 and giving it a once over and so forth?
Sure, great question. So ultimately, all of the above, but the first step and the first engine to test is to put it in a cell, which, you know, in layman's terms, looks like a big bank vault. And the engine goes inside the cell. It's got a fuel line running to it. It's got a massive water line running to it so that it provides the counter torque the engine needs to not overspeed. And the engine is running. It's a simulation of being installed in the aircraft, but it's in the test cell at this point. And certainly, as we move through our cooperative research and development agreement with the Army, which I believe we'll speak to a little bit later in this podcast, we will ultimately be installing it in the CH-47 in conjunction with the Army and Boeing for both ground and flight testing.
Okay, and just tell us a little bit more in terms of the real differences between the A and the C, the 714 sure. and C, because you know you've spent a lot of time producing the sure. A. Now this is really the next big step.
So ultimately, we're providing a 22% increase in power. So the 714C will be a 6,000 shaft horsepower class engine and also have an 8% lower specific fuel consumption. So as I spoke to at the beginning, you know, really increasing the flight range, increasing the lift, but also increasing durability, reliability, and maintainability. So we really, you know, we've had the power plant on the CH-47 for the entirety of that platform's existence. And during that time, you know, we've developed 7 engine upgrades. We started at just over 1,000 horsepower, and now we are into the 6,000 shaft horsepower class, as I said. And during that time, the shape and form of the engine hasn't really fundamentally changed. And a lot of the original design elements are still present in the 714A. As we moved into the 714C, we really took those engagement with maintainers and with the operators and implemented some very common sense changes that quite frankly, we probably should have done long ago to improve the reliability and maintainability of the engine. So in addition to the improved performance, we reduced mean repair time by 28%. By moving some LRUs, by getting rid of some of the unnecessary safety wire and lock wire and cotter pens, and really making it a more user-friendly design.
Okay. And on maintainability there, as you mentioned, reading previously that Honeywell on where the T55 is produced out of Phoenix now has both a repair and overhaul facility as well as a new engine line. Can you talk us through about the significance of that and what it's meant for the company?
Sure. So, you know, engines have been produced, so new production engines have been produced in Phoenix for quite some time. Until 2020, we were doing our repair and overhauls primarily in Greer, South Carolina. So for those not familiar with U.S. geography, those two facilities are about 2,000 miles apart. And so, of course, co-locating them provides some pretty significant synergies. So a couple of the biggest elements, one, we can optimize the utilization of people. So, you know, we run a multi-shift facility like many other organizations. And let's say, you know, on first shift, we have some repair orders that need to be completed. But on second shift, we can flex those R&O folks to the production site as it's only about 7 blocks away. And we can literally have our workforce flex back and forth where the priorities are on any given day. It also allows for shared tooling and material resources. And most importantly, our technical team is located here in Phoenix. So when there are problems that need to be solved on the repair line, as an example, we have a one-off repair. There's something that we've never seen before or some level, as has happened in recent past, of actual combat damage. And we need our engineering team to consult on executing that repair for the customer. They're right around the corner and can respond very, very quickly and help our customers get that resource back to them as quickly as possible.
Right. So, I mean, it sounds like kind of greater efficiency at the coalface then.
Absolutely.
Just in terms of, we mentioned beforehand, CRADA, so that's the Cooperative Research and Development Agreement, for listeners, again, if they're not overly familiar with the program. It's led by the U.S. Army, and it's for the T-55 integration and for, as we mentioned, the 714C specifically. So, TJ, can you give us a kind of more of a deep dive into CRADA, you know, how it came about and ultimately what the key requirements are at the Honeywell end?
Sure, absolutely. So the CRADA, the Cooperative Research and Development Agreement, is a Honeywell-funded partnership. And with the intent of proving the efficacy of our engine upgrade and build upon the legacy of our power plant in CH-47. So what the CRADA is an agreement between the U.S. Army and Honeywell to work together on this project. And we're going to collaboratively mature this engine technology from you know, we've been working with them for about a year now. And so as we mature this technology from design to test in the test cell, to ground test, to flight test, us, Honeywell, along with the U.S. Army and also with Boeing, will collect data and demonstrate the ability of this engine to meet the CH-47 requirements that the Army has established for that platform. So the government is providing use of its laboratories. It's given us people. We are using their facilities and equipment, and also in some cases, U.S. government owned technical resources as well. But again, all paid for and funded by Honeywell. So the outcome ultimately, as I said, is to have the CH-47 fly with 714C engines installed so that we can collect real-time flight data and validate our design. Really, we want to prove, I mean, our desired outcome is to demonstrate the unique drop-in capability of this engine. So this engine requires very minimal integration and or structural changes to the CH-47 platform in order to put it into operation. And then, as I said, validate the testing that we're getting in our laboratory setting in real time in a flight test.
Okay, and once testing is complete, I mean, ultimately, how many of the engines will be integrated on the Chinook, and will it also be integrated on the Block 2 program as well? Is that an intention or is there potential for that?
We have one aircraft that the U.S. Army has allocated for flight testing. So there'll be two engines installed and two spare engines that'll be used in the creative process. As of right now, that platform will not be a Block 2, but hopefully that's something we may be able to accomplish in the future in conjunction with the Army and Boeing.
Okay. And just on the technological side of things, because when it comes to power plant manufacturing, particularly in the rotorcraft industry, there's often talk of additive manufacturing and ideas like that. I mean, how much does that influence the design of the new T-55?
Great question. Certainly, we leverage additive manufacturing in our design process and to enable more rapid prototyping and rapid iterations in the design. We're not planning to use additive in the production engines, but has proven to be a very critical and beneficial part of our design methodology.
Right. So yeah, as you say, it's probably, I suppose, important that it's gone in to help in the development and speed things along, so that it's absolutely worthwhile. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of interest from other customers and so forth, I suppose those types of questions and considerations will be for the U.S. government to take forward. But I'm sure you're hopeful from a business point of view that they're are additional Chinook contracts signed then? I mean, because clearly that would mean all the better for Honeywell and additional production when it comes to new engine.
Absolutely. The global fleet is currently a little bit over 900 Chinook aircraft, and about 530, 540 of those are in the U.S. But certainly we'd like to see that international fleet continue to grow, and we'll support both the U.S. Army and their FMS sales and Boeing and their commercial sales in order to achieve that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just finally wanted to discuss maintenance. I mean, I suppose from the counterinsurgency missions that were completed and from which the Chinook would have been involved in the likes of Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth, you know, sand ingestion would have been one that came up. I mean, is that something that the new T-55 will make easier, for example, and for future operations? And, you know, how much consideration went into, high and hot operations, you know, extreme weather conditions and so forth?
Sure. So a couple of points there. You know, so you asked the question earlier about the co-location of our production and maintenance. And one of the key benefits that I didn't mention was that we also get, as we are repairing engines in Phoenix, we also get closed loop feedback from that in-service repair team that can go directly to our technical team and design team. And so when we observe some of the things you talked about, and maybe it's blade erosion from operating in a sandy environment, maybe it's, you know, corrosion from operating in a saltwater environment, and we can take those lessons learned directly into our continuous design improvement and have leveraged those in optimizing the design of this new engine. And so the 714C offers a 25% improvement in overall reliability, as I think I mentioned earlier. And that's mostly driven by a 40% improvement in the compressor life. So we have a robust new compressor, and the redesigned compression module is really at the heart of the 714C upgrade. And that's what drives the improvements in power and fuel consumption I talked about, but also also that improved reliability and robust life that you mentioned. You know, the high hot and heavy type of mission that folks usually equate the CH-47 to, given our 20 plus years in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, certainly as we look at the next conflict moving forward for the U.S. Army and its allies and other operators of the Chinook, I don't think the high, hot, and heavy is going to go away. It's just going to be in a different part of the world. I didn't mention this at the beginning, but I have over 20 years as an Army helicopter pilot myself, so very familiar with the type of environment that these aircraft need to operate in, and have leveraged that experience in helping the team ensure that we are providing the best product for the warfighter moving into future conflicts with peer and near peer adversaries in parts of the world we haven't operated in many years.
DJ, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much for giving us your thoughts on and giving us latest developments on the T-55. It's been, a real pleasure. So thanks so much.
You've been listening to the final episode in Series 3 of the Weekly Defence Podcast. We'll be taking our traditional midwinter break, but we hope to return with a new season next year. While we're on our break, we'd love to hear your thoughts about the podcast. Feel free to contact us on info@shepherdmedia.com. It only remains for me to say Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.